You're listening to The Bulletin with UBS, first broadcast on the 17th of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we're shining a spotlight on climate change and taking a detailed look at the first report from UBS to measure the impact of climate change and its effects on the middle class around the world. Entitled Climate Change, A Risk to the Global Middle Class, the report was presented at last week's Greater China Conference. In today's edition, we'll hear from its writers and contributing analysts, as well as the report's sponsor, and as always, we'll feature global perspectives from some of Monocle's international contributors. We start with Caroline Anstey, Global Head of UBS and Society and Group Managing Director at UBS. Caroline provides some context and explains the overall significance of the report.
It really underscores the point that there is no safe haven from climate change. I think up to now a lot of very good work has been done on the impact on the poor, the impact of those living in low-lying areas, coastal areas, but there's a great danger that we think this is either something that's going to happen to other people or something that's going to happen a long way down the line to future generations. I think this report makes clear that for the middle class, there are real costs, whether they're insurance costs, their costs through potential higher taxation.
Next, we hear from our regular contributor and co-author of the report, UBS Global Economist Paul Donovan. Paul describes the starting point for the research and identifies two critical issues, including the political potency of the middle classes when it comes to climate change.
The approach that I and my fellow authors took with regards to this was to say, well, what we want to try and do is narrow down where climate change is having a big impact on the middle class. Now, why select the middle class? Well, really, there are two reasons for that. Firstly, because the middle class have something to lose as a result of climate change. They have assets, and those assets, particularly assets like housing, can be damaged by issues of climate change like extreme weather conditions or flooding. As a result, the middle class is likely to be very sensitive to issues around climate change if they are going to be affected. And secondly, and perhaps I think this is the critical issue, the middle class is politically important. The middle class votes where it's a democracy, or they form protest groups and agitate through social media where it's not a democracy. Politicians from virtually every country in the world pay attention to the middle class because the middle class is politically significant. Now, that means that if we are seeing climate change have a significant impact on the middle class in certain countries, we're likely to get a policy response from the government of that country in time to try and mitigate or perhaps remove entirely the threat of climate change to its population.
In the light of these dynamics, is political short-termism a problem? As Paul Donovan goes on to explain, this issue ties back to why UBS is focused on the middle class issue. Paul also reminds us that looking to the past can be instructive too.
The debate about short-termism versus longer-term consequences is one of the reasons why focusing on the middle class is perhaps so important, that the middle class tend to have better levels of education, they tend to be taking somewhat longer-term views. And whilst, of course, there is always a degree of short-term expediency in middle-class voting patterns, there does appear to be evidence that the middle class is more inclined to consider some of the longer-term issues around climate change. And I think this is a phenomenon that has become more apparent as the consequences of climate change itself has become more apparent. If we look at past periods of economic downturn, say the economic downturn in the early 1990s, what we found was that a lot of issues around climate change were quickly dropped. And governments were focused entirely on getting the economy to recover, and environmental change was pushed off the agenda. But if we look at the aftermath of the global financial crisis and the economic credit crunch that took place from 2008 onwards, what we find here is that governments actually have maintained their environmental concerns and very often have dressed up economic stimulus in environmental clothing. So I think that the longer-term considerations about climate change and its consequences have started to become more relevant in the political process, and in some cases are being used to help justify short-term political expediency.
How does all this analysis lead to action? What are Caroline's aspirations?
Well, I think you're already seeing action coming out of Paris, and of course the proof will be in the pudding, and we have to go forward in that domain. But I think Paris and the COP21 that took place there, the UN conference, was significant, not only because a deal was struck, which hadn't happened over the last few years, but more importantly, I think you saw civil society and the private sector be much more involved in a UN process on climate than they have been. So you are seeing action already and action on the horizon. I think what is significant is you're already seeing people, in a sense, voting with their behavior. If you look at some behavior already, you see whether it's in the fair trade movement, whether it's in buying organic food, whether it's in sustainable investing, people are beginning to behave differently in terms of consumption patterns or lifestyle patterns or investment patterns. And I think you're going to see more of that. So the important thing about the effect on the middle class is that the middle class has political power, and with political power comes political reactions. And I think that ability to mobilize on things, whether it is around energy efficiency, whether it is around emissions, whether it is around national or international legislation, you're going to see more of that. And you'll see governments respond to that kind of public pressure that you're already seeing. And I think you're already seeing that in instances all around the world.
As Paul Donovan explained in last week's programme from the UBS Greater China Conference, where the report debuted, China is front and centre when it comes to both challenges and solutions in this area. Here's a reminder from Paul of why this is the case.
Well, China's presidency of the G20 group this year is putting quite a lot of emphasis on environmental issues and environmental growth, including, of course, issues around environmental finance. China itself is at risk from climate change. Its water use is a huge problem. Several of its cities are vulnerable to climate change. And then, of course, there are additional issues like pollution and so on, which are affecting the overall climate. So for us, China is a key part of the debate around climate and climate change, and I think may well be taking quite a leading role this year through the G20 chairing.
Paul Donovan on the role of China. And still to come on the Bulletin with UBS, we'll hear from the region on how the climate change issue will shape thinking in the year and years ahead. We continue with an international perspective, this time focusing on the climate change challenge as it relates to that key global protagonist, China. Isabel Hilton is the editor of China Dialogue, which focuses on global environmental and sustainability issues. What are the main challenges, in Isabel's view, for the country? She explains that one critical component here is the shift in mindset in China from why mitigate to how.
I think that there are some things that are still a problem. So verification is still a problem. Countries make their promises, they sign up. How do we know that they've kept them? You know, how do we know that they're not backsliding? What kind of verification regime can we have which national governments won't regard as intrusive? So that'll be a problem. There will be an argument about money, as there always is, although that doesn't primarily involve China. And I think that there will be problems for China post-Copenhagen in implementing this ambitious program. So they've promised, for instance, a national carbon trading scheme to set up very quickly. That has quite a lot of technical work still to do. And turning the great tanker of the Chinese economy around is not going to be easy. And as we move from the why mitigate climate change to the how, all the vested interests, all the people who are going to lose out, all the people who are really quite comfortable doing what they're doing, they're going to fight back. And that's going to be very interesting.
Isabel Hilton. We've heard of you from China. What of the other arguably key player on the global stage, the United States? Paul Donovan has already explained that many suggest the climate change issue can and indeed must necessarily be settled by the US and China in concert. Is that right? We asked Monocle's bureau chief in New York City, Ed Stocker, how the climate change narrative plays stateside.
I think politically there is certainly more will than there was in the past. You just have to look back to the Kyoto Agreement in 1997, which the US failed to ratify, to see that at least the country is willing to engage more than it was in the past. I think there is cynicism. I would definitely agree with that. But there's also quite an interesting indicator in a recent poll from the New York Times teaming up with CBS that said 2/3 of Americans would support the US joining a binding international agreement to curb growth of greenhouse gas emissions. Now, if we look politically, as I mentioned before, if we look at Obama, he certainly in this last bit of his presidency is stepping up. He's definitely saying that things need to change, and he has been quite vocal about climate change in Paris, talking about the economic and security imperative of tackling climate change. I think one of the biggest problems is the fact that Republicans are massive cynics, and obviously Republicans control Congress. Actually, living here in the US, you see that parts of this country are on the front line of climate change. Just look at California. I mean, the residents there know what's happening. There's a drought that's lasted 4 years there and serious issues as a result. It's pretty hard to deny that that's not the result of climate change. In Miami too, the government of Miami Beach investing millions to try and tackle rising water levels and flooding that's been the result of that. So those are two areas where, you know, people who are living everyday lives are seeing climate change. So I think because of that, there's suddenly a slight shift, but I think the political will suddenly from the Republicans is making it hard to do anything.
Monocle's bureau chief in New York City, Ed Stocker. When it comes to the most dynamic and potentially exciting ideas, what sector should we look to? Are there crucial differences between the public and private space? Is it the banks and think tanks that are doing the best work? We asked Paul Donovan where he looks to find the freshest ideas.
For many years, climate change was something which was largely in the scientific community. So it wasn't even in economic terms a major consideration, or it came in a very, very diluted form in terms of mainstream economic thinking. And what we had was a very small number of environmental economists and then a lot of scientists who were warning of climate change and biologists who were seeing implications of it in plant life and so on and so forth. What has happened over the course of the last 10 to 15 years, I would say, is that the issue of climate change has first broadened out into a more significant economic consequence. And then from that, in recent years, this has become something which is now starting to affect the private sector as well as academic think tanks and so forth. This shift, I think, is opening up new ways of thinking about climate change and ways of thinking about how climate change can be tackled through adapting existing financial and economic structures.
So is all of this indicative of a shift in the narrative away from governments and supranational organisations to, instead, a new focus on the role of the private sector in finding solutions? Caroline Anstey, again.
I think there are roles for both. I think the public sector is going to set, if you like, the regulatory environment around standards, around disclosure, around emissions. But the private sector, I think, is increasingly coming up with innovative solutions to how we bridge some of the financing gap. I mean, one of the issues coming out of Paris was that for developing countries, emerging economies, to do the adaptation and mitigation, there need to be large sums of money on the table. There isn't enough money from governments or from development agencies to fund that. And I think what we need to see is how the private sector can get behind, whether it's green infrastructure or green growth or low carbon energy. So meeting that financing gap to ensure that you can have sustainable growth and sustainable development does mean bringing in the private sector. And you're already seeing that. I mean, one very simple evidence of that is the increased use of green bonds. People are now individual investors, institutional investors, investing in areas which will support climate change mitigation or adaptation. I think you're going to see many more of those financial instruments or financial approaches to bring in both individual and institutional investors. And my belief is the appetite is already out there from investors to get involved in those areas.
And that's Caroline Anstey bringing us to the end of this 67th edition of the Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance every week here on Monocle 24. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or catch up via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.